From our North Carolina Reading Service Weather Balloon Studio, here comes Indy Week. John Feddersen here once again with Hurricane Ian approaching the Carolinas today. I've once again been tethered to a larger gas bag and sent aloft to read you this issue dated September 28th of 2022 to our audience of blind and print impaired folks. Now, you can tell our theme music is much quieter this week, as there was not enough, nearly enough space up here for the entire North Carolina Symphony, who remain far below in our parking lot. Beautiful job. They're hoping the rain will hold off before the end music for the program. The publication date, as I mentioned, September 28th, but this program is being recorded on Thursday, the 29th of September. And I better get to it. What do you think? As we often do, we go to IndieWeek.com, which has some later datelined stories than on the 28th publication date. And this first one from Jasmine Gallup about the Freedom Park in North Carolina, which is in downtown Raleigh. It's under construction on a one-acre site on Lane Street, located between the state legislature and the governor's mansion. It is the first monument on or near the Capitol grounds to honor black North Carolinians. The centerpiece of the park, a 40-foot-tall metal structure dubbed the Beacon of Freedom, was installed this week after traveling to Raleigh from Denver, Colorado, where it was built. The beacon will stand at the intersection of five walkways to be inscribed with quotes from black North Carolinians who fought for freedom. Each night, a beam of light from the beacon will illuminate the park. The design is the work of legendary late architect Phil Freelon, who also led the design team for the Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. The park was one of Freeland's last designs before he died in 2019 for ALS. The Freedom Park was first conceived in 2002, but it took two decades and a lot of fundraising for the $4 million project to become a reality. Construction finally began last year and is expected to be complete in the coming months. A grand opening is set for 2023. The next story by Tomasi McDonald about the North Carolina Council of Churches and abortion rights. This week, the influential religious body here in North Carolina affirmed a resolution in support of the right to an abortion that its members first adopted more than 50 years ago. The headline above a column published in the Washington Post over the weekend declared, "I don't want your God in charge of my health care." Writer Kate Cohen, in the September 26 column, describes a scenario where a patient is considering tubal ligation after a planned cesarean section because she doesn't want to get pregnant again. Wrote Cohen, factors that may affect the patient's decision are her version of her reproductive future, her doctor's advice, state regulations, the recommendations of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Factors that most patients don't consider are God's purposes, God's will, or the truth that life is a precious gift from God. This week, an influential religious body here in North Carolina affirmed this resolution in support of the right to an abortion that its members first adopted more than 50 years ago, 3 years before the U.S. Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade struck down several Texas laws that criminalized abortion. The North Carolina Council of Churches, NCCC, in 1970 issued a resolution during its annual assembly that urged, quote, faith communities, faith leaders, physicians, and hospitals to support the right of a woman to end a problem pregnancy by therapeutic abortion. In late June, Roe v. Wade was overturned by a much more conservative U.S. Supreme Court, whose members include at least three followers of the Catholic faith. Cohen did not mention the religious makeup of the nation's highest court, but the columnist did point to a 2020 report by a nonprofit health advocacy group that found four of the 10 largest health systems in the United States were Catholic, and that number is likely to grow. NCCC officials stated in the release that the religious body reaffirms its commitment made 52 years ago, and, quote, strongly declares that reproductive choice is a health care decision that women should make in conversation with trusted friends, family, and medical providers without embarrassment, excessive cost, and unwarranted delay. And the council, according to the release, stands by those words today. Reverend Dr. Jennifer Copeland, NCCC's executive director, stated, "It's been over 50 years since the council needed to speak about reproductive health, a testimony that, while imperfect, our nation did have guardrails protecting a woman's ability to make her own health care choices. As those guardrails begin to weaken in some places, we feel we must speak again to affirm the decision-making agency of women." Meanwhile, the Reverend Isaac Villegas, the NCCC's governing board president, stated in the release, quote, "Women are in the best position, with the wisdom available in their communities, to discern what's necessary for their well-being and their families," adding that the laws of our society, quote, "should not infringe upon the dignity of pregnant women in their health care decision-making." Now, back to the print edition by Caitlin Breedlove, an op-ed, Alleviating Hunger. It's an op-ed. "As the manager of the Durham Farmers Market, I've had the privilege of meeting and talking with the many families utilizing our Double Bucks program. The Double Bucks program incentivizes the purchase of local food by doubling SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps, and Farmers Market Nutrition Program benefits, as well as providing cash for WIC recipients, that's women, infants, and children, and Durham Housing Authority residents at locations like farmers markets. This is a huge benefit for many individuals and families in our community, especially as food costs continue to rise. However, the future of the Double Bucks program in the Triangle is uncertain. Current funding is coming to an end, and unless another funder steps forward, families who rely on Double Bucks will have to make do with less in a time when many families are already struggling to put food on their tables. With the stated goal of ending hunger by 2030, the White House has organized listening sessions throughout the country to evaluate the success of various food benefit programs. What they have found is that these incentive programs, like Double Bucks, are crucial to alleviating hunger. We hear a similar sentiment week after week at the farmers market. One local teacher described what DB, Double Bucks, means to her. As a teacher, I can often find myself frustrated with the politics of North Carolina. DB feels almost like a nice reward for hard work that isn't economically valued. It makes it easier to do what I love and live the life I want. I lost my job during the pandemic, and a friend suggested I sign up for EBT. I've always been a farmers market attendee, but it hasn't always been the most economical choice. With DB, the farmers market is my first choice again for grocery shopping. Durham and Orange counties have one of the strongest, most innovative Double Bucks programs in the country. The program, which started in 2013, now runs at 11 local farmers markets. In 2021 alone, the program brought in about $230,000 to the economy from six markets and helped well over 400 families put food on their tables in Durham alone. And it continues to grow. Markets saw an 81% increase in customer shopping with Double Bucks in the 2021 market season. With proper investment, there are many more SNAP recipients and local farmers who can benefit from this program. Groups such as the American Heart Association, Rural Advancement Foundation International, USA, Durham County Department of Public Health, and Durham County Cooperative Extension are working tirelessly to find funders so families and farmers will continue to benefit. We are seeing public investments of the Double Bucks program all over the country. This is what ensures sustainability to these impactful programs. One possible funding source is the American Rescue Program funds that Durham City and County both received. Many other municipalities are using ARPA to fund their communities' incentive programs. Other possibilities, including allocating local government revenue, private sector funding, and individual donations, however it's funded. The Triangle needs to come together to ensure that the program that has helped so many continues to support our farmers and help families thrive. In the words of a customer, on Social Security income, I can't afford to eat non-processed food. The double bucks have been a free gift of more food, less depression, and probably a longer and happier life. Being able to feel like a part of society and helping to support local farmers definitely reduces some of the stress of relative poverty. And Jasmine Gallup again, news from Raleigh, Faculty Flight, which is the cover story from Indie Week this week. Rolad Berry James, a public administration professor with a long list of credentials, left NC State University last month for a position at Virginia Commonwealth University. When asked what prompted her resignation, Berry James just said two words, fair pay. Berry James was not looking for a new job. She had worked at NC State for 12 years, both as a full professor and the chair of the faculty. She is a distinguished researcher with 35 years of experience in academia, plus a prestigious fellowship. But what happened last month was the last straw. In mid-August, Berry James' request for an unpaid leave of absence was denied, in part because she would not disclose her, quote, personal reasons for the leave, she says. She resigned her position at NC State the next day. The administration responded with a retention offer, typically an offer of a raise or other benefits in an effort to keep an employee, but Berry James declined, she says. While I had a short time to consider the retention offer, only fair pay would have kept me at NC State. I left a small piece of my heart with the Wolfpack. I love the awesome students, engaged faculty, and brave campus leaders who shared my vision for fairness and justice. I hope to get back to the campus someday. Unfortunately, this is a familiar story. Since January, at least 10 black professors have left NC State University for greener pastures. Their reasons for leaving weren't all the same. Some mentioned pay equity. Some talked about the additional burden of work placed on black faculty. Some said it was simply easier to seek a job somewhere else where they could pursue their professional goals. But one sentiment came up again and again. Faculty members say they felt undervalued. Repeatedly, they say the university did not seem to value their work and didn't seem to care when they left. Efforts made to keep them were modest at best, and proposals of significant pay raises were rejected. Warwick Arden, the executive vice chancellor and provost for NC State, did not address allegations of pay inequality or additional burdens of work in his response to the Indy's request for an interview last week. Instead, he deflected blame, writing, quote, the reasons why individual faculty and staff leave the university are varied and often include receiving significant promotion, career and personal advancement opportunities at other institutions or in the private sector. That is not untrue. Two professors who left the state said they left in part to pursue other career opportunities, but they also talked about the barriers minority faculty members face. The inability to advance their careers at NC State, a quiet form of discrimination in which the university pays less attention to their work, cuts their funding first, and expects them to work harder for less pay than white co-workers. Berry James said, the lived experience for underrepresented minority faculty is different, and yet sometimes our experiences are the same. My story may be familiar to many others. Louis Rivers III, a black environmental justice scholar, left his job at State in January for a local research position with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. This was 2 years after he received tenure, a status many academics worked their whole careers to achieve. Rivers said, citing a $6 million grant he helped bring to the university last year. A lot of us feel like we're just severely underpaid at NC State. That $6 million is a decent chunk of change, and half of the grant goes directly to the university. The rest is doled out by administrators to pay graduate students, among other things. One of the final straws for Rivers was the university's refusal to allocate $70,000 to hire a postdoctoral researcher, he says. Quote, "This is a person with a PhD. I just got to the point where I brought in a fair amount of grant support for the university, but then I'm hustling to support my students. You kind of feel like you're not getting paid the best, you're not being treated the best, but it's fine. But it became even more frustrating when I felt like they weren't paying our graduate students right." Rivers says being a professor, especially one of color, is not an easy job. Quote, "If you're a black professor, you end up being an informal mentor to pretty much every black student on campus, which is fine, but it is a lot of invisible labor." While professors who spoke to Indy all say they enjoy supporting and mentoring students of color, they also agreed it was an extra burden of work not placed on white faculty members. Ryan Emanuel, a Native American environmental science professor who left State for Duke earlier this year, says there was often a silent expectation he would reach out to Lumbee students. Emanuel did not leave State because of issues of racism or discrimination. He was happy with his job there and left to pursue better professional opportunities, he says, but he noted some of the issues minority faculty members face. He says, being one of the few Lumbee professors causes excess burdens of service and advising. "I don't mean to say I don't love interacting with students, because I do, but at the same time, we want recognition that we have this extra burden of mentoring and role modeling for students who want to interact with the faculty who have similar life experiences to them." Rivers, who knew Emanuel and another minority professor who left the college in January, Jason Coupe, who taught public administration, says NC State's administrators simply don't realize how exceptional some of their faculty members are. Coupe was not available for comment to this story. Rivers says, "I just don't think the university realized how special these people were, and they just didn't value them. NC State does not value the work of women and minorities the same, so if you get an opportunity to go somewhere else, it's easier." Joy Guston Gales, an education professor and advisor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, DEI, at NC State, is also troubled by the wave of minority faculty who resigned this year. Last month, one of her colleagues, a tenured professor who was at State for almost 20 years, became the eighth black woman to leave the university in 2022. She wrote in a recent op-ed for education magazine Diverse, Issues in Higher Education. She wrote, "As I examined my list further, I realized that half the black women were full professors who have made extraordinary contributions to their respective fields. I also know that many of them may have stayed if they were paid equitably, provided greater opportunities and pathways to advance their careers, and didn't have to navigate racialized, gendered, and hostile work environments." At NC State, as at many other colleges and universities, black faculty members make up only a small percentage of the overall academic staff. Black faculty are most present in the lowest levels of academia. About 1% of assistant professors at State are black, and at least present at the highest levels. Only 0.4% are full professors. Gales writes, "The academy remains white and steeped in whiteness because efforts to diversify the academy are performative rather than transformational." In other words, colleges are talking the talk, but not walking the walk. They're posting DEI sentiments on their website, but not working to change the culture of the university, Gale writes. They're not fighting to keep black women the same way they're fighting to keep white men, she argues. Quote, the fact that so many black women can leave an institution in such a short time period and no one notices or says anything and no visible changes are made to prevent this from happening is a clear example of misogynoir, anti-black racist misogyny. Quote, it isn't easy for black women in the academy to love institutions that do not love us back. Writing this editorial was not easy for me, but necessary. Institutions must do better to care for the humanity of black women on college campuses. According to Walter Robinson, a climate science professor who has worked at the university for over a decade, NC State has made an effort to recruit black and minority faculty members. Their efforts to retain those members are another matter. He says that search committees who are hiring new people are making an effort to diversify, but if we're not keeping minority here, then we just don't see the progress. I don't sense urgency from the chancellor and the provost to say, we really have to diversify our faculty. Robinson says he and many faculty thought the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020 would be a wake-up call to the university. But since then, he hasn't seen a genuine, intentional effort from administrators to recruit and keep black faculty. And he says, given the small number of faculty of color, especially those on the tenure track, each such loss hurts. The college made a diversity and inclusion a key goal in its 10-year strategy plan, a fact highlighted by Provost Arden in his email to Indy. But Robinson thinks university leaders could be doing more. The departure of minority faculty not only discourages students of color from becoming professors, but also discouraging other minority faculty from applying to work at NC State, which ultimately hurts the community and its research, according to Robinson and others. It's similar to the debacle with the acclaimed journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, who was initially offered an untenured position, then offered the tenure for which she was more than qualified following an outcry at UNC Chapel Hill. Several faculty members left UNC after that news spread nationwide, and the university gained a reputation for being hostile to faculty members of color. Arden says NC State is, quote, dedicated to advancing a culture of diversity, equality, and inclusion and belonging. This includes a strong commitment to recruiting and retaining underrepresented faculty members. And he concludes, while we have continued to make progress over the last several years, there's still much that can be done to improve equity in higher education, including at NC State. And our next Indie Week article from Durham, again by Tomasi McDonald, Minister of Justice, about Reverend Ben Chavis. It was exactly four decades ago this month that Reverend Ben Chavis, while sitting in a Warren County jail for driving too slow, came up with the term environmental racism. Chavis ended up in the Hoosgow for driving down a road to lead Warren County residents who were protesting the dumping of deadly toxins in their community. He said on September 15th, while speaking at Duke University's Wilson Lecture to commemorate 40 years of work with the environmental justice movement, quote, that night in the Warren County Jail, I thought to myself, not only is this wrong, this is an environmental wrong, and it's tantamount to environmental racism. More than 500 people were jailed beginning in September 1982 while protesting the state officials' decision to dump in predominantly black, rural, and impoverished Warren County more than 60 tons of polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, a highly carcinogenic substance. The protesters' crime? The men, women, and children of Warren County lay down on the highway to block the toxin-carrying trucks from entering their community. The Warren County residents' brave protest augured by 7 years the bold defiance of an unidentified man who stood in front of a column of tanks in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, China, to protest the government's violent crackdown on protesters. When the residents of Warren County used their bodies to defy the trucks carrying the toxin that arrived in their home that fall, the environmental justice movement was born. Chavis is the descendant of a long line of clergy members and educators. His great-grandfather, John Chavis, was the first African-American to be ordained a Presbyterian minister in the United States. The cause of civil rights is in the junior Chavis's DNA. At the age of 12, scholars say his determination to obtain a library card at a whites-only library in his hometown of Oxford eventually led to its integration. In 1967, Chavis was a college student at UNC Charlotte when he became a civil rights organizer with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Today, Chavis is widely recognized as the godfather of the environmental justice movement, which was born in Warren County. While speaking at Duke this month, he gave credit, quote, to the women, children, one of whom was only 4 years old, a child arrested by the state of North Carolina for lying down in the road to block the trucks. Chavis said that about 2 years before the protests, a company in the Northeast dumped the toxins along North Carolina's highways, and state officials, including former Governor Jim Martin, decided to move the substance, and of the state's 100 counties, chose the state's, quote, most predominantly black county for its relocation. Chavis said, while speaking to a group of students, former professors, supporters, and family who had gathered at Duke Chapel, I'm certain that state officials, including the governor, knew it wasn't appropriate to put tons of toxins in a poor rural community that got most of its water from wells. It's the last place you want to dig a hole and dump tons of toxins. Warren County was deliberately targeted. And what we found out after more than 500 people who were arrested 40 years ago, excuse me, that was a phone call that should not have come through, and we'll just repeat my last paragraph. Warren County, said Reverend Chavis, was deliberately targeted, and what we found out after more than 500 people were arrested was that it brought national attention and the discovery that what was going on in Warren County was not isolated. He added, similar environmental challenges were taking place in Louisiana, Mississippi, Arizona, and New Mexico. Moreover, Chavis noted, by 1985, the Environmental Protection Agency under the Reagan administration was in the denial about the existence of environmental racism. There's been a significant turnaround regarding the EPA's stance on environmental justice since the Reagan administration, or even the Trump administration, that was at odds with the World Health Organization on top of its withdrawal from the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. On Saturday, Michael Regan, the EPA's top administrator and a Goldsboro native, stood on the steps of the Warren County Courthouse and announced the agency is launching a new Environmental Justice and External Civil Rights Office. Regan, whose remarks appeared in North Carolina Health News, said, quote, we are finally ensuring that communities who have long borne the burden of pollution see, breathe, and feel the benefits of the federal government's investments. It's about changing how our government works and who it works for, something that so many of you today have dedicated your life to realizing. Regan also touted President Joe Biden's commitment to elevate environmental justice and civil rights enforcement at the EPA and across the federal government and ensure the work to support our most vulnerable communities continues for years to come, according to an EPA press release. According to that release, the new office will oversee the implementation and delivery of a $3 billion climate and environmental justice block grant program created by the Inflation Reduction Act and the law's historic $60 billion investment in environmental justice. The United Church of Christ responded to the Warren County protest by commissioning a landmark study, quote, Toxic Waste and Race in the United States of America, that relied on statistics to give evidence about the role of race and the location of toxic waste in communities across the country. Chavis said, the environmental justice movement grew first through the courage, persistence, and sacrifice of Warren County and others who joined together to build a movement. Prior to arriving in Warren County 40 years ago, Chavis had risen to national and international prominence as a leader of the Wilmington 10. Scholars and historians say Chavis was working with the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice in 1972 when he and 15 high school students were arrested for setting fire to a white-owned grocery store and shooting at firemen and policemen who answered the call. Chavis, along with 8 other black men and a white woman, was convicted of arson and conspiracy to assault emergency personnel. They became known as the Wilmington 10. Chavis entered prison in 1975 after his appeals were exhausted. Meanwhile, Amnesty International designated the group as political prisoners due to the weak evidence used to convict them. It was the first time Amnesty International used the designation for people behind bars in American prisons. The U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the sentences of the Wilmington 10 in 1980, who justices deemed their incarceration was a consequence of prosecutorial misconduct. In 2012, Chavis and the surviving members of the Wilmington 10 were issued pardons of innocence by then North Carolina Governor Beverly Perdue. When the United Church of Christ dispatched Chavis to Warren County to lead the PCB protest just 2 years after he got out of prison, Chavis said this month, the last thing I wanted to do was get arrested in North Carolina. He landed in a Warren County jail cell, though, after a state trooper charged him with driving too slowly on the road leading to the protests. He said, while sitting in his jail cell, he began to define the term environmental racism as racial discrimination in public policy making, with the deliberate targeting of communities populated by people of color for toxic waste and hazardous waste facilities, and excluding people of color from public policy making. Chavis pointed to the water crises in Jackson, Mississippi and Flint, Michigan, but he could also have pointed to the town of Albemarle in Stanley County, where the poverty level is nearly 25%, and officials with the long-closed Alcoa aluminum smelting plant wanted to increase the amount of cyanide it discharges into Baden Lake, a popular fishing and swimming destination and a drinking water supply for Albemarle residents, according to reporting from Policy Watch. State officials blocked the move. Chavis noted the progress that environmental justice movement has made over the past 14 years. It's now global. But he also said there are still formidable challenges and noted the convergence of environmental justice deniers with the same elements across the national and international landscape who deny climate change. Pointedly, Chavis said those same forces want to deny people the right to vote, deny women's reproductive rights, and deny that systemic racism exists. He added, one of the lessons of the pandemic was the disproportionate impact it had on communities that were exposed to environmental hazards. And he said, the earth belongs to the Lord. The earth doesn't belong to polluters who create toxins. Hannah Stepnick now writes, it was a partnership, this article, between Indy and Ninth Street Journal, journalism students at Duke University. And Hannah Stepnick writes, election disruption. Across North Carolina, self-proclaimed defendants of election integrity are disrupting day-to-day ways county officials preserve the integrity of elections. The effort seems to be a new strategy by people who promote the lie that Donald Trump won the 2020 election. A nationwide barrage of public records requests to county boards of elections. The effort is delaying the officials' ability to do their jobs, hiring poll workers, ordering ballots, and all the other things required to run smooth elections. Patrick Gannon, the public information director for the North Carolina Board of Elections, said county offices are being flooded with requests. Quote, they're not only coming in the form of emails. People are showing up at election offices with public records requests. They're showing up with video cameras as they drop off the public records requests. They're emailing them. They're mailing them, faxing. They're coming in by the hundreds. Gannon noted that requests are going to all 100 county boards in the state. Public records requests to boards of elections are useful tools for journalists, researchers, and any person who is genuinely curious about the state's voting process. The requests are normally just a trickle and can be handled by election staffers. But lately, counties across North Carolina have been overwhelmed, as have counties around the country. Certain type of requests seem to come in waves, election officials said. For instance, they've reported receiving an influx of demands to see cast vote records, CVRs. Those are files of scanned ballots, usually used by academics and auditors. It is illegal to release them to anyone but election officials in North Carolina, although legal in some states. Gannon said the high volume of requests has become such a burden they are distracting workers from the important tasks of preparing for the November election. Quote, it's having a great effect on the ability of county boards of elections and staff to focus on this task at hand, and that is conducting a fair and accurate 2022 general election. Anyone who says otherwise is simply wrong. I talk to county directors every day. I email with them every day, and it's definitely having an effect. Besides asking for records that cannot be released under the law, many of the requests are just arduous. Daniel Lassiter, the voter service manager at the Durham County Board, mentioned a request he got this year for the result tapes of the 2020 NC Supreme Court race between Sherry Beasley and Paul Newby. The tape, which is different from a cast vote record, looks like a long receipt, so it was tricky to figure out how to scan it onto a single page. Lassiter says that did take some time to do. He also described a recent request to produce every email his office exchanged with about 15 organizations, a task that required not only tracking down the emails, but redacting sensitive information. Gary Sims, Wake County Election Director, said the request can't be time-consuming for election workers. Some of these are very, 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 very cumbersome, he said. It could be looking at a 10-foot tape, or if it's early voting, a 20 to 30-foot tape. How do you even copy a 20-foot document that's only 3 inches wide? Some of them, logistically, were trying out one after another. Although the requests appear to be coming from individuals, several election officials report language that looked cut and pasted from a template. But the official said answering these requests is their job and said they intend to fulfill them. Lassiter says, I don't really have time to hunt down and search who these people are or what they're using the information for. That's not really our goal. Our goal is to respond in a reasonable time, which is what the law states. We all do what we're obligated to provide, Sims said. Still, officials seem a little jumpy. For when asked for clarification about what zero tapes are, Michael Dickerson, the Mecklenburg County Elections Director, paused for a moment. Dickerson said, if I tell you that, then geez, now everybody's going to ask me for it. Are you looking for it? I'd never heard of Ninth Street News. No offense. I'm not trying to be funny. The correct title is actually the Ninth Street Journal. When asked what groups might be behind the request, Dickerson said that's not part of his role. That would be your job. It's a public records request to me. I do not care. Sims sees groups behind these requests as a complicated web spanning the country and state. Picture one of those CSI crime shows where they have the wall and they take this string and tie this person with this person. A key figure in the flood of requests seems to be Mike Lindell, the MyPillow CEO, who has been a leader among election deniers and hosted a national conference in August in which he called on people to seek vote records. According to the Washington Post, he's worked with Jeff O'Donnell, who goes by the alias The Lone Raccoon, and runs a website filled with falsehoods about election security. In North Carolina, the requests appear to sprout from a number of groups, some easier to spot than others. They include We the People, Transparent Elections NC, and the North Carolina Audit Force, whose Telegram channel carries messages from the Lone Raccoon. One Lone Raccoon message calls for a hidden army of election deniers. Others refer to news accounts reporting the truth about American elections as hit pieces. Officials in bigger North Carolina counties are better able to deal with the flood of requests, although challenges persist. Sims says, thankfully, I was able to get a person who is dedicated just to handling public requests. But no matter what, it not only tries to tie up our office, but it ties up our communications office and also our county attorney's office. Smaller counties lack these resources. They might have a lawyer on retainer, but it's less likely they have a full department. Lassiter said Durham is considering hiring a full-time employee to deal with the requests. Still, he considers himself fortunate that the county hasn't been as overloaded as other areas. But for some officials, the chaos is beginning to hit a breaking point. Sims said he has heard from election directors in other parts of the state who no longer want to put up with the abuse and pressures of the job. In his office, he tells his colleagues to send him any angry phone calls or disruptive individuals who show up at the door. He said, "You want to call and yell at me or cuss at me or threaten me? Okay, if that's what makes you feel better." It's important, he said, that his staff members stay focused on doing their job, running North Carolina elections. Quote, "All these people that are trying to do this, do they want people to quit? Well, how is democracy supposed to work if you don't have good people making sure things are done properly? And that's the part that, I guess, is a little sad or disheartening to me." All right, let's move away from the hard news and go to some arts and events. Starting with stage, our column by Byron Woods called Stageless. The numbers have looked encouraging. No less than 18 separate shows running simultaneously on stages across the area as we've headed into the largest regional theater and dance season in years. That metric, along with the 5 new companies we reported on in previous coverage of the fall season, speaks to significant new growth as artistic communities return to active practice after 2 years of fluctuating levels in social and artistic lockdown. But even as the newest of the new, including LGB Productions and Firebox Theater, opened their first works, disquieting developments were unfolding offstage with the potential to affect not only their long-term health and survival, but that of fledgling companies like them. As the season starts, 3 venues that in the past have dependably provided a home for such groups, Pure Life Theater, North Raleigh Arts and Creative Theater, that's NRACT, and the Renaissance Center in Wake Forest, have either seen their spaces close or signaled that they are unable to host groups at the level they previously have. Why is that a big deal? Over 2/3 of the region's 90-odd theater and dance companies are itinerant, with no permanent rehearsal or performance spaces of their own. Before they can develop and place new works in the public eye, they have to find a place that lets them show up in the world. Since demand for affordable, reliable spaces that can also serve as functional theaters has always outstripped the available supply, new arrivals in the numbers that we're seeing are likely to place further stress on a performance ecosystem already ill-equipped to handle the artists here at present. David Henderson, co-founder of Honest Pint Theater, says venues is extremely difficult. Venues for small, itinerant companies are hard to find. Since its inception in 2013, the independent group, Honest Pint, has regularly won superlatives as one of the region's strongest companies. While planning its current season, it has also struggled to find a viable space in which to present its work to the public. After Pure Life and Enract, the two companies that had hosted in recent years, both unexpectedly flashed the no vacancy sign. At Enract, a full season of 8 productions precludes presenting other companies through next June. Timothy Locklear says, managing artistic director, we've got to recoup what we lost from COVID. Paying top dollar rent during the lockdown on a retail space in a Tony North Raleigh shopping center burned through most of the company's savings and donations. Locklear says, we're just trying to get back to a place where we can continue. The people at Pure Life certainly didn't think they would join the ranks of the nomadic themselves this fall. Since January 2020, the group had shared office, rehearsal, and performance space with a collective of itinerant companies, including Sips and Scripts and Seed Art Share, and hosted groups, including the enigmatic Other Only Windows at its base of operations in Raleigh's Royal Bakery building. But when faced with a significant rent increase on top of intractable noise issues from an adjacent event space, the group made plans to transition to a new venue by midsummer. After those plans fell through at the last minute, company co-founder Deb Royals-Mazurk says, we had to literally move the theater twice. It took a huge toll on us, both physically and on our psyches. The group had to put its office and theatrical equipment in storage. Then came the challenge of finding new locations for the 5 productions that Pure Life had already planned. Its season opener, a notable August production of August Wilson's Fences, landed at William Peace University. A Motown cabaret sold out last Friday in Wake Forest. Subsequent shows will play this winter and next spring in Durham, Raleigh, and Kerry. Royals-Mazurk stresses that the company is still actively searching with real estate brokers for a venue, quote, where we can share space with the emerging companies we've already committed to working with. Until it does, the 9 companies named in its collective must look elsewhere for places where they can be seen. Whatever solution they come up with will come too late for the fall season at Forest Moon Theater. The company canceled the season after learning it could no longer secure its longtime presenters at Renaissance Center, a performing arts venue run by the City of Wake Forest, for a 2-weekend run for its shows. That's the minimum booking that almost all itinerant companies believe they need to stay sustainable. Conventional wisdom and company track records across the region suggest that theaters come close to breaking even after family and friends attend a show's first week and usually only make a profit from word-of-mouth ticket sales in the second week. That hasn't been a problem in the venue's early years. From 2015 to 18, Forest Moon ran full seasons of 4 multi-week shows at Renaissance Center each year. But in 2019, the center asked them to cut back to 3, the last of which was canceled at the start of the pandemic. Given the struggle everyone was experiencing, attempting to return from lockdown over the last year, Forest Moon acquiesced to a 2-show season, with a single weekend run of The Odd Couple in October, and a February production of The Diary of Anne Frank, which the company then canceled with the advent of the Omicron variant. Push came to shove, in a meeting last month in which Forest Moon board members told management at the center they couldn't survive on single weekend shows and were offered only a single weekend slot in the fall and spring seasons. The company's counter request for a single production running two weekends was also rejected. When Forest Moon subsequently went dark this fall, the move surprised and saddened the center manager, Debbie Dunn, who says, "I didn't realize we were moving in that direction." Both sides acknowledge that space has gotten tighter as demand for private and public bookings at that center has increased in recent years. It's also agreed that Forest Moon has never sold out the center deliberately, according to company director Bob Baird, since sight lines in the room make viewing a stage play difficult beyond the fourth or fifth row. Baird says, "We've tried to limit our house to a maximum of 100 seats. I'm sure we're not a money-making proposition for them." Though the Renaissance Center's mission statement includes presenting community theater by name, such bookings involve a delicate balance, according to Dunn. Since the venue is funded by the city, it has to critically consider and favor bookings that generate larger audiences. At the same time, Dunn acknowledges that problematic sight lines has kept theater houses small and says the venue is testing a staging technology this fall that might help solve that problem and permit theater groups to mount productions that will be visible to full houses. And even if it works, though, with growing demand, she's uncertain if Renaissance Center will have room in their calendar going forward to accommodate Forest Moon's traditional four-show seasons. Dunn says, "Still, we are huge fans of Forest Moon and have worked very hard to keep them, help them be successful. At the end of the day, we're all trying to do the same thing, which is bring art to our communities. As it turns, others are making concerted effort to loosen the space squeeze in the region this fall, and not a moment too soon. Stay tuned," writes Byron Woods. I believe I must close this issue of Indie Week with a partial music review by Tomasi McDonald about Brian Horton's last song. Brian Horton looked like a jazz man. He cradled the tenor saxophone like it was a lover, closed his eyes to press the keys and caress it. Horton was a consummate reed man who gave it his all, always intent on blowing breaths of love and life, heaven and hell into his instrument. For the past 3 years, on Tuesday nights, Horton, tenor sax composer and newly named director of jazz studies at NC Central, led a trio of musicians, horn, upright bass, and drums, at the Kingfisher Bar in downtown Durham. On September 14th, 2 days after missing that weekly gig, officers with the NC Central Police Department found Horton dead inside his Durham home. He was 46. 6 days shy of his next birthday. Last Tuesday night, on September 20, Horton would have been performing at Kingfisher. Instead, Horton's fellow musicians, students, university peers, and everyone else who loved the man and his music gathered at North Star Church of the Arts in Durham to honor and celebrate his brief, albeit impressive, legacy. Leonora Helm Hammonds, NCCU's interim department chair and director of graduate programs, jazz and music, said school officials called the Durham police and asked for a wellness check at Horton's home after he did not show up to teach his classes. No one answered the door when the police arrived. The next day, university officials filed a missing person report and campus police went to his home and discovered his body. The officers notified Durham police. Although Horton's cause of death has not been made public, NCCU police reported no signs of foul play. "He didn't look harmed," she says, adding that social media has been buzzing with folks demanding answers to the unexplained questions about his death. "That's all we know," I says. "I promise you that's all there is to it. We're not hiding anything." Grammy nominated jazz vocalist Nina Freelon, who co-founded the North Star Church with her husband, the legendary architect Phil Freelon, months before Phil died in 2019, was among members of the city's jazz community who gathered at that sanctuary last week to honor Horton. Freelon sang a song that Horton wrote for her. "Brother Horton," she said, "I think he thought he had some more tomorrows. I thought he had some more tomorrows, but with this thing we call life, we don't come here to stay. So he's given his tomorrows to us." Horton was ever the teacher, even on the bandstand. Kinston native and NC Central trained alto saxophone Eric Dawson told Indy he sat in with Horton at Kingfisher about 3 weeks before he died. Dawson floundered on the bandstand that night. He told the Indy, "I ain't really been playing that much. Brian dropped a jewel on me. He called me and told me I needed to take that ass whooping and go home and come back next week and not talk about it. He lit a fire under me." Another Kinston native, Brian Miller, who's also a NCCU-trained alto sax, had also recently shared the bandstand with Horton at Kingfisher. "We played," Miller told Indy last week. "I mean, we played. Anytime me and Brian got together, there was a mutual respect and love for one another. Brian would keep you on top of your game." "It's tough to talk about because Brian would keep you honest," Miller added, a sob catching in his throat. "Brian wouldn't let you fake it. He was genuine. He wasn't doing this because he was trying to show you up. He wanted you to be at your best." He was born on September 20th, 1975, in Kinston, a little over 100 miles east of Durham. During a professional career that spanned more than two decades, he toured and recorded as a bandleader, a sideman, and arranger, playing alongside jazz greats like Billy Taylor, Betty Carter, Clark Terry, and Sir Roland Hanna. Well, I'm feeling little tugs on my weather dirigible, and I believe that the people on the ground are beginning to haul me down after my reading of the Indy Week this week, that is to say, John Feddersen. This program will be available as a podcast at the ncreadingservice.org website. Yes, I am moving down. The rain hasn't gotten here yet, and as I can hear in my symphony beginning our theme music, as I begin getting closer and closer to the ground, welcome relief. Although I did enjoy the view, it's going to be mighty windy in a few hours. So we'll be back next week with another edition of Indy Week. So long, folks. Land ho!